I'm Justin Oldham, and you're listening to another Politics and Patriotism podcast.
This is our time.
Haven't we heard this somewhere before?
This is our time.
Anybody who votes should be skeptical.
How's that hopey-changey stuff working out for you?
Voting is one of the most important things you can do.
Okay, let's make this quick. I got a hot dog in the microwave.
Think for yourself, and don't be fooled by the spin.
I understand your frustration and your cynicism.
Your sense of right and wrong is the only thing that keeps them in check.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
You have a very rare talent of being able to cut through the hoopla.
Watch your language, you bud. We're on the air.
And I'm pleased to have back with us today Martin Bain from the Above Politics show, and he's got a different perspective on the budget cut situation here in the United States because he's over in Britain, and we've recently talked about what the British budget cuts are going to do to the British military, and now in the wake of the November elections, the Republicans have swept to power in the House of Representatives, and they've closed the gap that they had with the Democrats in the Senate, and now the majority leader in the House of Representatives is promising 22% budget cuts across the board here in the States, which sounds decidedly British. And you know, the very first thing, Martin, that leaps into my mind is that aren't we flashing back to the 1930s here? Because all of a sudden I can see 2 years from now America having a large navy and a tiny army and not really just giving a fig about what goes on in the rest of the world. And, you know, that didn't work out too well for us last time.
I don't share that view of this is how America is going to look in 2 or 3 years' time, because there's one big thing. The U.S. is the largest consumer of crude oil. In the 1930s, you supplied your own crude oil, and your own requirements for crude oil typically came from fields that you either had in the country or you had access to very quickly and very simply. Whereas today, that's not the case. So I don't see it sort of being that absolute model. What I see is it being a smaller continental military. Yes, I'd absolutely agree with that one. What I see, I think, is going to be some, maybe not cuts in the sort of draconian way that maybe a lot of people see them, but more in that there will probably be less of what you call as a conventional army, and probably spending will shift to the Navy, because that's how you protect your sea routes and also project power around the world. The other one I think will be a greater emphasis on, and I think we mentioned this last time, about special forces. Now, you know, I'm not necessarily meaning tier one, tier two special forces, but I mean maybe more elite units, maybe like the, you know, the US airborne divisions, like the Marines. And I think the Marines could, if they play their cards right, come out of any fiscal constraint actually fairly well, because they have the ability to, you know, go on a ship and then be used to project US power wherever the US needs it projected. What I suspect will also happen is I suspect the National Guard budgets will probably be fairly heavily cut. So I suspect it's, yes, you will see cuts, but and I think within the whole budget for the DOD, I will see some rebalancing, and I would agree with you. I see the continental land-based army in the States probably being fairly heavily cut. I even think the Air Force is probably going to have to take a brunt of that one, because typically the US doesn't have today, you know, indigenous enemies that it needs to have a huge Air Force for. In the Cold War, it's a lot of its Air Force was deployed outside of the continental USA. So I'd agree with you. The Navy, yes, but I think a redistribution of the smaller budget within the continental landmass.
You know, I put the word out before we started this conversation today, and I managed to get a few questions emailed in to me, and three of the respondents all made the same observation. Now, with so many governments like yours and mine going through these terrible budget cutbacks, are we actually seeing the decline of Western power?
No, I don't see that. Again, I think I see a rebalancing here. I don't think all of a sudden in 40, 50, 60 years' time the West will no longer exist. If you sort of take the global economy, where are the biggest consumers of the global economy? They are in the West. They are in the first world nations. That's not to say that second, third world nations aren't coming up, but at the moment we are still in the first world. The first the top 20-30 countries are typically Western. That is where the greatest consumers and are. China, if you look at it, is struggling really hard to develop its own indigenous consumer economy. Even India, to a degree, doesn't have, whilst it has a huge economy, the sort of, you know, the spread of the consumer technology in rural China, in rural India, still isn't there. So they still have to heavily rely on the fact that, you know, you and I and a great many of our friends and the people we know want, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 inch plasma TVs, LCD TVs. You know, we're quite happy to replace them on maybe a 2 or 3 year cycle. You know, we want the latest electronic gadgets, we want the latest games consoles, we want the latest in fashion. So I don't see anything that would suggest to me right now, Justin, along with the people who emailed in, is that this doesn't feel like the decline of the West. Interestingly, I'd always like to have a debate with those people to say, okay, if you see a decline, what do you see replacing it? Which I think is even more interesting when someone says, I see something declining and this is what I see it being replaced with. And that's what I'd like to know from these people. What do they think, if they passionately believe that the West is declining, what do they see it being replaced with?
Well, actually, knowing these people as well as I do, I don't mean to speak for them, but I know that their primary examples will be the growing economies of China and India most specifically, and actually the resurgent Russia indirectly, but I honestly think that's just a vestige of the old Cold War. But I will have to give them that one, that the rise of China and India, especially China in particular, can very well mean a shift away from U.S. power, and I can foresee a situation 10 years down the line where, for example, Chinese deep water forces outnumber our own, and when it comes to them and their territorial interests, especially with pursuing their oil and minerals agenda in the China Sea, you know, they're not going to be that impressed with the arrival of a U.S. nuclear aircraft carrier much anymore.
This program is brought to you by ShadowFusionBooks.com.
I'm not entirely convinced by that statement about China being this huge global power. I think a lot of people see, yes, China will become the largest economy in the world. That I have no doubts about. But that's, to my mind, for one simple reason. It's the most populous nation on the planet.
Okay, now there was a point in time when the United States was the population leader, and when we had the industrial base to rival what the Chinese had today, the case can be made that we engaged in many of the same behaviors then than they're engaging in now.
See, yes, I would accept that to a degree, but I think there are very fundamental differences between the US and China in the model and its creation of its economy. The US was never a rural economy in the sense of the word that, you know, a vast majority of the people were either subsistence farmers or farmed to feed the rest of the population. The US has never sort of been in that mold. And I'd say that mold also applies to a degree to India. But a vast majority of people in China are what we would regard as poor. They probably survive on maybe $50, $60, $70, $80 a year. And there's just too many people for China right now to have an economy that is going to be servicing potentially 1.5, maybe even 1.6 billion people. just because it's got a large economy doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to have the capability to project its power. At some stage, China will have to make some very big decisions about whether it focuses more of its economic growth internally or it will continue to grow externally. And one of the things I see is I don't see China continuing to be the economic growth for the next 15 years. I don't see it being that long, because at some stage, people in China's expectations, particularly on the coast, will start to grow. They will want to be paid more. They will want more luxury. So China is going to have to make a couple of decisions. One, does it sell these nice fancy TVs to us in the West? Or does it start to encourage its own internal economy? You can, of course, say that China can just go and build another 150, 200 factories. That's, I think, a very flippant answer. The other thing is just because China's wealth and the sort of wealth creation of its people will change, maybe China will not be in maybe 15 to 20 years' time the cheap labor economy that it is today. So then you have to think, where is it going to go? And if you actually think about, certainly from a European perspective, Justin, about where things move from, say, let's say, take for example the UK, Germany and France. I'm not belittling any of the other countries, but they're just good examples. The first move, particularly in the automotive industry, was to move to Eastern Europe when Eastern Europe opened up. In the past 15 years, companies that had moved their manufacturing facilities from the heartland of Europe to Eastern Europe started to pick that up and move it to India, to China, to, you know, the Far East. So you saw countries like, for example, Poland, Yugoslavia, or what was Yugoslavia, and other Eastern Bloc countries that were regarded as low-cost economies maybe in the 80s and 90s, actually no longer being low-cost economies because their economies had developed and their people now had an expectation that they wanted to have a flat-screen TV. So it moved around the world, and at some stage that will happen with China, that will happen with India. If you go on to say about, great, so China will have a bigger deep sea fleet than the US, great. Just because you have a superiority in weapons doesn't mean that you have the knowledge, the tactics and the techniques to actually use them effectively. If you think about, you know, how forces operate, the British military has typically always operated being relatively smaller than who it was attacking. If we take, for example, the Falklands War, the UK military, if you took the whole military, was not as big as the Argentinian military. Yet we had the expertise, the technology and the capability to project a war 8,000 miles away from our own country. Argentina couldn't project a war maybe even 400, 500 miles away from its own coast. So I don't think you can necessarily say, oh, look, China's got a huge number of ships. It's suddenly going to be this power projection monster that's just going to turn up on the coast of cities and towns and countries and say, oh, by the way, this is China. I don't see that. I think people see China as doing that. And I just don't think that China is actually going to do that. China's real issues are within the borders of China. I don't think their focus is in the borders of China, not externally. They will come after assets and raw materials. Absolutely, they need to, because for them to continue to grow and be successful, they need to have the internal parts of China growing and developing. And that's what's lacking today in China. The coast, politically and power and economically powerful. Once you go into the heartland of China, where probably 1.2 billion people live, it's still a very poor subsistence lifestyle for a huge number of people in China.
See, now you've just demonstrated why I think these conversations are so important, because the vast majority of our American listeners, I don't think, will have heard anything like the perspective you've just laid out, and I honestly find it encouraging. So let me move things along a bit by reaching into the mailbag and pulling out a curveball here. With all of that optimism in mind, where do we stand in regards to dealing with Iran 10 years out?
Iran. See, I suppose 2 years ago maybe, I probably did think that there may be the foresight and the political and military will to engage Iran in some kind of military activity. Today, I'm not entirely convinced that that's what the US wants to do. So, you know, what do we do with Iran? Well, I mean, I certainly think there needs to be dialogue with Iran. Clearly, their nuclear program is something that should concern all nations of the world. But you can understand why Iran would want to have a nuclear weapons program when you think of the region it is in. You know, Israel, despite the fact still denies it has nuclear weapons, I think any sane, logical, sensible thinking person on the planet would absolutely say, with the acquiescence, knowledge, help of the US, it has acquired nuclear weapons and has the capability to manufacture them, store them, and deploy them.
I just find it amusing that so many Israeli politicians have been photographed in, around, and near nuclear facilities, and yet they step in front of the nearest TV camera to say, "We ain't got none."
Yeah, and that's just politics. It's absolute rubbish. You know, you had somebody who spent Vanunu, I think he was a scientist or someone involved in the Israeli nuclear program, who basically came clean to, I think it was the Times newspaper, and then got arrested for it. So I think nobody would turn around and say Israel hasn't got nuclear weapons. Then you sort of turn to other countries in the region. Syria. Now, does Syria have nuclear weapons? I think it would like to have aspirations, and I suspect it probably had a program to develop nuclear weapons. But does it have one today? No, I don't think so. If you think of the power balance in that region, Saddam Hussein had an active program at some stage to acquire this technology. He wanted it purely because he wanted to become the regional superpower. With the Americans stepping in and smacking him down and taking him down, it's put a shift in the superpower relationship in the Middle East. And clearly Iran sees itself as being the regional superpower. So that's why it has a nuclear program. One, I think it was initially to counter what Saddam Hussein was doing, also to counter the fact that Israel had nuclear weapons. So clearly we do need to sit down and have a serious dialogue with Iran and try and understand what their intentions are. If you say take that one stage further and say, right, okay, we cannot have a dialogue with Iran, there is going to be a military engagement with Iran. I just don't see the kind of military engagement there was with Iraq working in Iran, because the Iraqi military really wasn't that strong, that up to date with technology. I would probably say it was pretty good, but from its tactics and its command and control mechanisms, it was very poor. Everything was very centralized. The coalition, when it went in, knew precisely what parts of the infrastructure to hit to basically cripple almost the whole system. I think in Iran, that's going to be a very different thing. So I don't see the Americans or a coalition going into Iran in the same fashion that they went into Iraq. So if you say, let's go for the military option, I think you may have to go back to the first Gulf War and the air campaign and then the ground campaign. The problem, I think, with Iran, Justin, is that I'm not sure we, the West stroke coalition First Nations, are prepared for the losses that could, and I suspect will, happen if we try initially an air bombardment of Iran to soften it up so at some stage we can deploy ground troops. So that's the first thing. I don't think we're going to want, you know, to every day know that, you know, another fighter, another bomber has been taken down, because at some stage, you know, the cost of an air-to-air missile vis-a-vis a weapon system such as, you know, the F-18s, even the stealth bombers, the varying stealth bombers, Eurofighters, and all those type of things, Iran could always have more surface-to-air missiles than we can ever have aircraft to go after them. So the balance clearly shifts in their favor.
I can definitely see your point, and I do agree. I do not think that the military balance sheet telegraphs any future moves against Iran, and I also see, just from being here inside the United States, easily for the next 8 years at a stone cold minimum. There is no political will for that kind of power projection. And as I watch the U.S. economy go further and further down the toilet, I begin to think that possibly for the next 20 years, until something flares up where we seriously feel like we must absolutely get involved, I don't say that we will be isolationists, but we will definitely be doing a lot more sitting on the fence than we have in the past.
I suspect the U.S. administrations in the next 15 to 20 years will project that as a public persona. I don't think that those on the tier underneath the direct administration have that mindset. They will still continue to meddle in countries where they think they can influence governments, where they think they can influence regimes. The Cold War may be shifting a little bit from maybe being focused exclusively on what was the Soviet Union and now Russia. I suspect we will have a newer and a very different type of Cold War. And you touched on it, that China will look to project some power. It needs to project power because it needs to have access to huge volumes of raw materials that it doesn't have in its vast country today. So I suspect there will be a shift in maybe let's go head-to-head with China rather than let's go head-to-head with Russia, and then let's find proxy countries to go and do that for us. I think to some degree Japan will factor in that one. I think Taiwan will factor in that one to a degree. And it's probably Taiwan that probably gives me most concern for anything kicking off potentially between China and the US. And I know when we last spoke, we spoke about, you know, some of the deployments of navies. I still absolutely believe that, as you know, the budget cuts bite for the US Navy, there will be a lot of traffic going one way through the Panama Canal, and it's going to be going from the Atlantic to the Pacific, or it will be going round right down the tip of South America and coming up. I suspect you will probably see maybe a 65-35 spread between the US Navy in the Pacific and in the Atlantic, because they will be needing to project power to fly the US flag in the Pacific. So I suppose from a UK perspective, that's actually quite a bit of a barrier to us, because potentially we've got the whole of the US and the Atlantic between us, and we've got the whole of the massive continental Europe and most of the Middle East and most of Asia to protect us from that. So that's where I see it happening. China will want to project power and will need to project power. And it's interesting that it's been looking to project power on the east coast of Africa.
That's very true. Now, in the closing minutes here, I'd like to get back to the matter of economies, which we discussed last time. Now that we know for a fact that the Republicans are going to be in the driver's seat in the next Congress, we're having to look at two serious issues which political infighting can only make worse. The first of which is that the current GOP leadership is now threatening to force the U.S. federal government into a temporary shutdown, and the second is that Nonpartisan Debt Commission has just released its early phase report, and now it appears that there's absolutely nothing in the budget that Democrats and Republicans are willing to cut. So I'm left with my original assertion here that the U.S. economy is going to march off a cliff, and that the people in Washington are going to be quite happy with defaulting on our debts. And I'd like to know what that looks like to you as an outsider.
Well, I guess I wouldn't disagree with maybe we ought to default on our debts. And, you know, the UK has fairly significant debts. What that does to the global economy, I don't know. I mean, one of the things I did notice recently was that the US credit rating, I believe, which would sort of imply, that's an interesting thing, which means that some people are saying, not as good as it was. I mean, one of the interesting things I see from looking in from the outside is that, great, so the Democrats and the Republicans in Washington are basically going to cripple each other. Sorry, what does that do for the millions of Americans? It does absolutely nothing. I think what it continues to show is the absolute lack of any credible government and administration in the US that can actually sit down and work together. You can be very critical of, you know, what's happening in the United Kingdom, but we have two political parties that were forced together to govern, which means that we probably do have, for the first time in a great many years, a more of a consensus government here. That just doesn't appear to happen in the States, is that, you know, a president, if he's really lucky, may get 2 years in a one and a two term presidency, where he's maybe got control of the White House and he's got control of the Senate, which means that he's basically crippled. So you can understand why, you know, so many people in America are up in arms with all these people in Washington who only go there to line their own pockets. And that is a very interesting thing, is that the US is held up as this absolute perfect example of democracy. Well, don't get me started on that one, because in most states, your vote does not actually directly elect the president. It tells an electoral college what to do. Sorry, that's not democracy. I'm sure we can talk about that in another show. The other one is, there seems to be no direct correlation between what the people in each state want and what goes on in Washington. Absolutely, the people in Washington do exactly what they want to line and feather their own pockets. And you can see why people are becoming so disenchanted with politics in the US, because all they see is these people in Washington getting paid huge sums of money for actually doing nothing. And all that happens is you get Democrats and Republicans just going for each other and not actually achieving anything. And there are probably millions of Americans who maybe would like their political parties to actually sit down in a room and say, guess what? We may not always agree with each other on 20-30% of things, but come on, we've got a population of 250 million odd people that actually needs us to sit down and actually govern. And that's the real sad thing about what is held up as the champion of democracy, is it's not really democracy. It's really in the interest of a few very powerful people that decide whether something will happen. And your president, Barack Obama, is a lame duck if he until the end of this term. I personally don't think he's going to do a two-term. He's not going to be a two-term presidency. He is crippled. He is a lame duck of the worst sort when you think of all the fanfare and all the hype when he came to office. Has it been squandered purely within the control of President Obama? No. I don't think you could blame Obama for what's happened. I think you have to blame the whole political machine in the US that basically enables the country to basically say, guess what, Mr. President, you haven't sorted my problems out in 2 years, I'm going to cripple you. And that's what the American people have done. They basically turned around and said, well, 2 years, you haven't sorted out, I'll give someone else another try, and in 2 years' time or 4 years' time, you'll change that again. And the worst thing is, it's very sad that I agree with you. I think the American economy and the American influence around the world is going to start to fall purely because of its political system. And I think it may need a radical change to turn around and say, no, the president and his party for the term of his presidency runs and controls the country.
Now, in the final minutes of the show, I'd like to give you the opportunity to do a few shameless plugs. So if some of my listeners are interested in finding your own stuff, where do they go to look?
There are a couple of shows. I mean, the Above Politics show, and certainly a lot of the things that I do, is centered around AboveTopSecret.com. And I know there's a couple of great radio shows on there. One is ATS Live, which is a live two-hour show that goes out on a Saturday, I think at 7 Eastern. And then there's also a European show that goes out at 9 UK time on a Wednesday. And guess what? You know, I enjoy the opportunity for you and I to get together. You know, maybe we ought to see if we can bring in some of those other people that you know who have even differing views to you and I.
Well, thank you for your time.